Today's KPR Presents was originally broadcast on March 6, 2016. From the Lead Center at the University of Kansas, KPR Presents An Hour with the WAS. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple Computer. Wozniak spoke at the University of Kansas on November 20th, 2015, sponsored by the KU School of Business. This event was moderated by the dean of the KU Business School, Neely Bendapudi, who started out by asking him to talk about his early years.
Well, before college student, I actually was a genius, but I look back on myself, but now I'm not. I'm only a genius at fooling people and making them think I am one by talking fast. I was doing electronic projects that, when I look back, they were in elementary school. They were the equivalent of master's degree programs in a college. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it. I was doing them for fun. There was no idea it was going to be a job. It was going to be money. It was going to be the big thing in life, computers and analog electronics before that even. That was just my fun thing. And I look back and I say, whoa, I went on such a perfect course to get so excelled in sort of academic ways, smart ways, but not in school. Because they didn't teach these things in school. And you can only teach a certain level in like elementary school or middle school. You can only teach to a certain level, and a young person can go way beyond that.
That's true, very true. So what are some non-Apple innovations of yours that college students in particular would enjoy?
Alrighty. By the time I got to the university, I had actually taught myself. There were no books in bookstores. There were no computers around, no computers in our schools. And I stumbled into little things by accident, and I had taught myself on paper with a pencil how to design with little logic circuits that I had learned in elementary school from knowing electronics and how electrons flowed through transistors and things. I taught myself to design on paper building blocks called chips made a computer. Oh, every weekend I would close my door. I was shy. I didn't have friends. I was just doing this all alone. I didn't know it was even valuable skill. I thought, I'm designing computers. I'll be an electrical engineer someday, but electrical engineers don't design computers. They design radios and TVs, satellite guidance systems, and all the stuff that uses high-level mathematics, and computers don't. So I taught myself how to design computers. I could design any computer in the world in 2 days coming out of high school. And that meant all the IBM computers, all the HP computers, all the Varian computers, digital equipment, Data Journal, all these companies that made computers. I loved to get their manuals and then design my own versions. So that's what I was going into college. Now, when I entered college, it was so early in computers, it was beyond rocket science. Introduction to computers was a graduate course. Introduction to computers, graduate level course. But being in engineering, I was allowed to take it, and I got an A+, because I kind of knew it all. But Now, for the first time in my life, my gosh, I could write programs and run them on a university computer. And I wrote so many programs that calculated the tables of numbers that scientists use. I was running my programs 3 times a day, and each program of 7 programs printed 60 pages. So you multiply of different numbers, and it cut off after 60 pages so I wouldn't run the computer over a time limit. And then I was calculating, reams and reams of output were piling up. I'd run my programs 3 times a day in my dorm, and they cut me off. I'd run our class 5 times over budget. I thought, you're in a class learning, you get to program. I didn't realize it boils down, in those days, it boiled down to budget for a supercomputer, and it was far more than out-of-state tuition at one of the most expensive out-of-state tuition schools in the country. Oh my gosh, this was scary stuff. They scared me that, you know, how could I ever possibly pay that back? But I was doing good things, but they called it bad. Electronics. One thing I like about electronics, I learned in high school, I was a big prankster, and they kept records of all these pranks that had happened. They knew I'd done them all, but they said, Wozniak's too smart, we can't catch him. One of the things that I did was I went down to a local Radio Shack and bought a high-speed transistor and wound some coils, electronic stuff, and I built a little tiny thing I could hold in my hand. And when I went to the one-color TV we had on campus in these days, these are old days, one-color TV down a dorm, people would go and watch it. I tuned it on. It was in the basement of a girls' dorm. I turned it on, and it would fuzz up the picture. A friend of mine whacked the TV. Oh, I made it go good. We hadn't even planned this. So then every once in a while, it'd go bad, and he'd whack the TV till it went good. And for weeks, they stationed a person in a chair next to the TV whose job it was to fix the TV when it goes bad. And we had tuning controls in those days. They'd tune the control, and then I'd make it go good, and they'd pull their hand away, I'd make it go bad. I should have had a degree in psychology playing with little guinea pigs. You know, I got them to I got one guy once to stand on a chair with the antenna up in the air to make the TV work. Another time, a hand in the middle of the TV and 1 foot off the floor on a chair made it work. And I never got caught for that. So that was a lot of fun.
The TV jammer.
Yeah. Mm. And then when I went to my computer class, a bunch of us, we underclassmen, had to watch it on 4 TVs. The rest of the upperclassmen got to watch the professor live. And I had a little TV jammer I built into a magic marker pen, and I turned it on. It just barely fuzzed up the TVs. They were closed circuit. One of them was jammed pretty bad. The one next to me was hardly jammed at all. Interesting how it was all different. But that's the old analog electronic days. And as soon as I did it, 3 TAs stood up. I didn't know we had teachers in the class. I was going to fuzz up the TV and turn it off. They stood up and they're watching us and they said, "Who's got the transmitter? Turn it off." You know, "Yeah, it's me." "No." So I'm sitting there thinking, how am I going to turn this off? The guy next to me will see me turn it off. They'll know who did it. Oh, no. I'll wait till the end of class, and when we all walk out, they'll never know. And I waited near the end of class. One guy near the TV that was jammed the worst picks up his books early, and he starts walking towards the door. As he walked to the door, it made the TVs go in and out. And then when he left, the TVs went perfect. And yeah, the TA pointed at him and said, "There he goes."
Well, I want to make sure you don't get ideas from all of this, folks.
Always trying to think a little bit differently. And I learned for a lot in my life that if you're going to do a prank, just don't do a normal one anyone would think of. You have to be creative. Creativity is thinking up your own little things. Do it a little bit better. Think of one extra thing that makes it one step further. So in the case of the TV jammer, I framed somebody else.
So one more of these stories, because you've got to tell us about how you tried to call the Pope.
Sure. Well, that was by a later year in college, after I'd even taken a year off to earn money to pay for college myself, not burden my parents. And that was the summer I met Steve Jobs and read this article, found out that there was a little device called a blue box that these weird engineers had come up with they had found flaws in the phone company. The phone company was a monopoly back then. And they found out that if you put tones into an American phone, beep, 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 if you put the right tones in, you could dial free calls anywhere in the world. This was shocking. It was fiction. It was a fiction article, I thought. And Steve Jobs and I ran down to the one place we could get to a technical library, the best technical library, because there were no technical libraries and no good technical books in libraries. Stanford Linear Accelerator Center was the top physics research place in the world, like CERN is now. And the smartest people in the world work there. The smartest people in the world don't lock doors. They tend to at least leave one door open. So I knew I could always drive in on a Sunday and go to the main building and find at least one door unlocked and get into their library. That's where I read journals and magazines about computers and discovered a lot of stuff. And we found out this blue box thing, beep, 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 that it was true. So I built one. I designed a digital one. It was really cool. And Steve was the one who said, "We should sell these." So we started selling them door to door in the dorms and telling people about them. We would always do demos. So one of the demos I remember doing late at night, sitting down in the dorm room, and I decided, let me call the Pope. I called Italy inward. I got them transferred to Rome inward to the Vatican. And I said, "This is Henry Kissinger with Richard Nixon at the summit meeting in Moscow. I'd like to speak to the Pope." And they said, "Well, so it's 5:30 in the morning here." I said, "I'll call back in an hour." When I called back, I used a little bit of an accent as Henry Kissinger, but I got to the bishop who was going to be the translator, and he said he'd just spoken to Henry Kissinger, so I was busted. But I told him I just wanted to make a confession.
I can't even imagine what would have happened if you had gone through.
That was Steve Jobs and I, our first company, you might call it, selling products. Because over the next 5 years, before Apple started, about once a year, Steve Jobs would come into town and see my latest little fun project that I built for myself, and he would all turn them into money. Yeah, he was the businessman because he had no money. He had to find a way to turn them into money. I just did it for fun.
Interesting. The engineer, right? The engineer mind. Tell us a little bit about HP. You talk so much about...
Yes.
You were an engineer way before you even went to college, from
yes.
what you've said.
I was an engineer, but back in the analog engineering days, true engineering, and some of you from the engineering school, it's based on a lot of mathematics and differential calculus to design circuits with precision parts. I learned that side of the world. And then digital, you don't need more math than fifth grade. I was shocked in fifth grade when I discovered that. Oh my gosh, all this little digital logic making and programming, it's just common, you know, steps that you take. So it's a different kind of engineering totally. It's not as, I think the mathematical formula type stuff is the much harder stuff, you know. Hmm. So anyway, where were we?
How did you get into HP?
So Hewlett-Packard, okay, I've had 3 years of college. I don't have an engineering degree, but I could design, like I said, anything I could think of. I could turn into chips and design, and I'd been doing it for some time. And so Hewlett-Packard heard about me, and they interviewed me. They were building the hottest product of the day, the hottest smartphone of the day. Call it the iPhone 6S from Apple, maybe, or you know, some other products. They were building the Hewlett-Packard scientific calculator. They didn't think many of these would sell. It was like a $2,000 slide rule, and slide rule sold for $10, $2,000 of today's dollars. This was unbelievable, and within 5 years, no more slide rule companies. Every engineer, every scientist in the world had to have digital numbers you could type in and get esoteric functions like sines and cosines and tangents to 10 digits precision. Unheard of. And they interviewed me, and the hottest product in the world hired me as a design engineer. I got to design those products. Yeah, that was a great one. But I called myself an engineer's engineer because Hewlett-Packard in those days only made the test gear that engineers used. Frequency dials and buttons and all the stuff that engineers did to look at signals. That's what we were building at Hewlett-Packard. So I called myself an engineer's engineer because we engineers at Hewlett-Packard were building the devices engineers used. Hmm. So, it was a great fun time. Now, we had a great camaraderie. The Hewlett-Packard values of the time were incredible. The highest level of decision making went to the lowest level of management. Hmm. You could communicate with anybody up the management structure, no problem. You didn't have to go through a hierarchical chain. They treated everyone like family. When there was a recession, instead of firing 10% of the people and putting them on the street without a job, everybody reduced their salaries 10% and took one day every 2 weeks off. Hmm. I loved so many things about that company. They gave us stock options based on profit. It was a recession. What were the profits? Every division of Hewlett-Packard was losing money, except our calculator division was so profitable, the whole company was profitable, and they shared it with us as stock, saying, we want you to be owners, feel like owners of the company. And all these values, you know, you're all part of a big family, really struck me deeply at Hewlett-Packard. Mm-hmm. We had great camaraderie. And then I loved designing things, engineering. When I went home from work, I was designing calculators in the daytime at Hewlett-Packard. When I went home, I was such a geek, I had no chance of a girlfriend or a wife. I'd watch Star Trek, eat a TV dinner, and then I'd start working on my own designs. Fun things, you know, starting the first dial joke. People heard about me, a guy in Hollywood. There were no movies in hotels. A guy in Hollywood came by and had me design the digital part of a first hotel movie system. And I got to design, you know, pinball games for kids and things like that. I mean, and I did all these designs for basically free. I just got a reputation because I loved doing it. And those were great Hewlett-Packard days. And then I started working on project after project after project. The ones that Steve Jobs came in town turned into money. I saw Pong. The first time, oh my gosh. A video game can be an art, can be like a pinball game, a television. And what struck me in my head was I had no money, and that forced me into the best decisions sometimes. How do you build something for somebody who has almost no money? I have a television. It's a free output device. A television can be an output device. So I built a Pong game with 28 little $1 chips, unbelievably inexpensive in that day. And then Steve Jobs came to town and saw it. So he took my board down to Atari Corporation in Los Gatos, California, where I proudly live now, Los Gatos. That's where the pet rock was invented. And the guy who invented still lives there. And Netflix is there. And we've got a lot of history. So Steve Jobs went down to Atari, and they thought he designed it. You know, he knew little electronics, but he didn't really design it. But he got a job. Steve had a personality where he'd always go to the top people anywhere and just start talking to them. Kind of impressive the way he would talk. So they hired him at Atari. Now, when companies are new, you get to go, you know, they're pretty open. And I could go in at Atari at night and see all the games they were building on the factory floor. I could get so good at them before they came out. You know, eventually I got good at some of their games like that. And I would be able to win free pizzas at pizza parlors, that sort of thing. It was a good, fun time. Yeah, and then next one was Breakout. I mean, these things are getting closer and closer to the computer that was really going to make personal computing a historic thing, a real thing in life, even though we did it for the wrong reasons and didn't know why when we did it. But there was the, from after that Pong game, there was a job to design Breakout. Many of you played Breakout, where you have a paddle and you hit a ball and it breaks bricks away. And Steve came to me and he said, I think he told Atari he could design it, but he couldn't design anything. He was never an engineer. He was never wrote a program. Didn't know what software was. So he came to me and he said, could you design it? I said, I would love to design a game that kids play. That would be fulfill my life, because two things were important to me, education and engineering. So I said, yeah, I'll do it. And Steve said, there's a hitch. You have to do it in 4 days. Hardware games were a man-year project. These were hardware days. Every Atari arcade game was black and white TVs, hardware, no software. You couldn't write a program in a day for a game like you can now. Oh my gosh, I didn't think I could do it as the greatest designer in the world in my mind. But I said, I'll try. I'll try. Did not sleep for 4 days and nights. Neither I nor Steve Jobs. We both got mononucleosis, the sleeping sickness, because our immune systems were probably way down. And we delivered a working breakout to Atari. That was quite a project. And then I then moved from there from games to terminals. I saw a friend typing to a thing called the ARPANET. Today we have the internet, reaches everyone in the world. Back then, the first long-distance network connected 6 universities in the United States when I first saw it. It was MIT and Stanford Research Institute, UCLA, UC Santa Barbara, Utah, and I think Illinois. And I could log on if I had a terminal, a teletype, an expensive machine that cost more than 2 cars. If I had that and a modem, I could log on. Heck, I can design anything. I designed a few little parts that I could afford and used my television so I could type to a computer across the country in Boston, and the Boston computer could type back to my TV. So that's getting closer and closer to a computer.
Hmm.
And then Steve Jobs came into town. He turned that one into money, too. But then he was back up his commune in Oregon. That's why he needed the money in 4 days for that one project so he could buy into the commune. And he came back into town, and by then I was in a club called the Homebrew Computer Club.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there, I'm thinking I'll show off my design abilities and I'll pass out for free how you can build your own terminal at home and connect to the ARPANET. And I found out these guys are interested in these microprocessors that could be computers, but those little computers were toys. They were toys that couldn't really do a job unless you put thousands and thousands of dollars in. You could get to barely, you could run a few programs for your business, that they were calling them computers. I had built that same machine 5 years before. When I met Steve Jobs, that's what I was building, a computer of my own design, because the company I worked for got me some chips for free. And so I was well beyond that in my thinking. Oh my gosh, I'll just take my little terminal that talks to a faraway computer, put the computer right here. It's called a microprocessor chip, which is the brains, and the right kind of memory chips that are affordable were the memory. You have to have memory to work a computer. And everybody else was using the wrong kind of memory chips because they weren't engineers. They were afraid to tackle the right kind of memory chips, are harder to design with. But I only save parts and cost. That's my design philosophy. Simplify everything to the max, design everything with about half as many parts as anyone else.
Hmm.
It's one of the reasons Atari hired me to do Breakout. Steve, I don't know if they knew that I did it. But they were tired that their games were getting up to 190 chips, and I designed Breakout in 45. They just knew that was my ability. So here was this little computer. I'd go down to the club every 2 weeks, demonstrate it. I was a hero at the club, people looking over my shoulder. They saw the formula for a personal computer. This was going to become the Apple I, but Jobs didn't know it existed yet. He was out of town. And I passed. No, but the social revolution was the important part. The fact that people were going to live life differently, that somebody could type a message in to their own computer, and over a modem it could be stored on a big computer, and then over an hour, 100 people might be able to dial in and see your message in 1 hour. That was big stuff. That was scary stuff, how much we could communicate. And education was going to be changed, and the geek was going to be important, revising all the finances of their own companies and beating the million-dollar computers with their own. Oh, I was so inspired. After I designed my computer, I passed out my designs for free. No copyrights or anything. You guys, build your own computer for $300. We've got to start this revolution. We were talking the word revolution in our club. And so then Steve came into town. If you saw the movie with Ashton Kutcher, show Steve dragging me to a computer club. That is so phony and wrong a story. I brought him down to the club I was a hero there, and I showed him how I would demo it in the crowd around me. And when he saw the crowd, he said, we should start a company. Well, we'd been a company for 5 years, but we should have some kind of formal name to it. And he wanted to build a little board that helps people build my computer. We'd build it for $20, sell it for $40. We figured out, if we sell 50 of them, we'll break even. And, big deal if we don't break even. We'll have a company of our own, with your best friend. So that's how we started Apple, except one hitch. I worked for Hewlett-Packard. I had determined I would be an engineer for the rest of my life, bottom of the org chart. I did not want to move up the org chart, didn't want to manage people, didn't want to push them around, didn't want to tell them I was superior, that I had better ideas. So I was going to be an engineer designing cool products, hardware and software, my entire life, and I would never lose my job at HP. I wouldn't give that up by starting a company on the side. So I pitched HP to build this computer. I told them what it would cost, what it would do, how you'd implement it and use it in your home. Wow, I caught a lot of attention, but for various HP reasons, they turned it down. They would have built a boring machine for engineers rather than the fun machine that people needed to bring a computer into the home. Computers were in stale environments. In those days, computers didn't exist. They were in businesses, and they were in places called research and the military. Nobody ever thought a computer fit a home. You'd have to have some fun element to it, and that's what I really contributed the most. I'll get to that. But Hewlett-Packard turned me down for the first of five times. And they finally built a project with all the same parts I had used, and yeah, it was a boring engineering project. You know, expensive, all the wrong decisions for the home. So too bad they turned me down. I mean, I talked to Bill Hewlett once, and I said, I wanted Hewlett-Packard to do this. And he says, well, win some, lose some.
But, I guess that's a good philosophy.
But I came from this club where we all us geeks, we were just hobbyists. We knew how computers worked, and we wanted our own. We didn't want to be subject to a company that owned a $1 million computer. And we had, our thinking was that every home in the world is going to have a computer. Everybody's going to learn to be a geek like us and program them and set them up and wire things with soldering irons. We were so far off base. But even Steve Jobs and I, once we got into a real company, we were off base too.
But it's fascinating that you had this grand vision of what could be. So it truly was a revolution in that sense.
Believed it would be important. We believed it would be important. We didn't really know the real reasons why. Like when turns out that, okay, this Apple I computer, every computer before the Apple I had big front panels like you see with all the switches and lights on them. You see them in movies. Mm-hmm. Every computer looked, this is not what we call a computer today. Every computer since the Apple I computer, since I demonstrated at the Homebrew Computer Club and everyone looking over my shoulder saw the formula. Every computer since then had a keyboard and a video display. That was the effective solution that made it affordable. But we actually, before we ever shipped these Apple I computers out of the garage, we knew it was a dead-end project. We were selling them anyway. Steve Jobs would sell anything. He was a great salesman. But we had the Apple II demonstrated, and the Apple II was the one I designed from the ground up as a computer. Mm-hmm. I didn't modify an existing project, and it had such beautiful things because you had to attract people in the home with fun. And I believe in fun going with productivity everywhere. Mm-hmm. And it had gaming. Gaming had to be the attraction. The Apple II was the first time ever nobody expected color. I figured out a way to do color for $1 instead of $1,000. The old analog way, $1,000. I have came out with a little digital way that was so weird and out of any engineering book ever, and it was $1. So color was part of it, but the more important part was probably that games could be software. You could write a simple program in a simple language. A 9-year-old could learn BASIC and write a program that says vertical equals 1, vertical equals 2, vertical equals 3, vertical equals 4, and make things in color move on a screen. That easy. Anybody could program their own games. This was going to change the world. Games would be software. And so that was an unbelievable attraction. We knew we had a hit product, and this was going to go a long way if we only had enough money to build enough.
Maybe this is a good time to talk about...
But I passed over the garage. I passed over the garage.
You passed over the garage, okay. But I think it's an interesting point, what you talked about, having the money to build a better product. Can you tell us a little bit about Mike Markla? I've heard you mention it. We usually hear... The Woz and Steve Jobs.
Well, we knew we had a computer now that we could sell 1,000 of. We were borrowing money on the parts. We had 30 days to pay for the parts for Apple I's in the garage, and we would build them up in 10 days, no lawyers involved, and we would sell them for cash to the stores. So that's how we kind of operated for half a year, knowing this Apple II, we could sell 1,000. How do you get the money to build 1,000? How do you get $250,000 was our question. That's like, how do you get $2 million today, maybe? And Steve Jobs was the businessman, so he was out pursuing every company, trying to talk top people into buying our product for actually very little money, as it turns out, and just giving us some stock and control of it. And we got some turndowns. Venture capital turned us down because we were in our young 20s. We had no business experience. We couldn't talk business language. You know, I mean, venture capitalist Don Valentine asked me, well, what do you think, what's the market for it? I said, 1 million. How do you know it's 1 million? I said, well, 1 million units. I said, well, there's 1 million ham radio operators, and this is bigger than ham radio. You know, I'd been a ham radio operator since sixth grade, so But and that's a good answer. You can't defeat that answer. It's going to be right, but it's not business talk. So he got us onto this angel, Mike Markula. Mike Markula decided that this was going to be the next big shooting. Home computers were going to be the next big market that comes about once every 10 years, where you can grow a company to $1 billion in 5 years. That was $1 billion way back a long time ago. So it's a big deal he's talking. I thought, well, the more successful you've been in life, the bigger a number you're allowed to talk. Remember, Steve Jobs and I were in our young 20s. We had no business experience, and we had no savings accounts in banks. We had no money at all. So Mike Markula invested the money. He owned as much stock as Steve and I, so he was an equal partner. And he directed us, here's how you set up a technology company. Here are the job positions you hire. Here's what you look for in their daily responsibilities. And here's what you pay them. And you have to have an agency that represents you and your image as a company, does your advertisements and all that. It has to be professional. He brought all that in, and he directed, we will be a marketing-driven company. Marketing is what makes IBM great. Understanding the customers, their needs, the values of the products and all that. And Mike Markula, our investor, ran marketing and eventually became a CEO of Apple. He was very instrumental. He's really the one who made the company, because Steve and I didn't know any of this stuff. And his principles on marketing are what Steve learned very quickly. Steve has a good mind to catch on to other people. Steve's role in the company when we started Apple was interface with everybody running the business, doing the high-end business stuff, and learn how they do the jobs and learn how to run every department in a company. And Steve just wanted to make sure he's at least on top. He's the founder of a company. This is very important. His personality changed. Your personality settles in your early 20 years, you know, 20 years old. He was going to be suit and tie, business talk only, forget all the calling the Pope stories and all that, you know. He got away from that for a while, but he got back to it by the end of his life, and really had those memories strong, you know, the good times. So we started a company, and my role, I was shy enough. I don't want to talk to press. I don't want to. I'm an engineer. I'm the engineer, the greatest engineer. I want other engineers to look at my designs and say, whoa, how did he think of that? And so we published all the designs and the software. Our marketing department didn't know yet about trying to be closed. So everything was open. Here's how you can build your own little attachments to our computer. Here's how you can write your software. We published everything openly, yeah. And that was the Apple II computer. That was going to be Apple's only successful product and revenues, I mean profits, for the first 10 years of Apple. One product was that good. It's really great when you can start a company that way.
So can you put it in perspective? We've been talking about it, the Apple I or Apple II, compared to the iWatch, the iPhone that we have today.
Well, these were starting, the Apple I, you kind of type in programs letter by letter and get a program in, it would run, it would print text. The Apple II was color. I mean, you could program things moving on a screen. That we still have today. We've improved the quality. So the quality goes up. It's like the resolution of a camera gets better. You have higher quality. The quality of the computers, the amount of electronic neurons called transistors that we have in today's products are a billion times greater than at least when I was in high school. I mean, back then you could make a chip with, let's say, 10 transistors, and it costs the same as a chip today costs with 10 billion transistors. And transistors are electronic neurons that do the thinking. So these products, theoretically, are so much more sophisticated, but a lot of that intelligence goes into graphics and displaying things on screen, a lot of ways that, you know, it doesn't mean it works faster for you, but it sure does do a much better presentation job than ever before. And the internet is a different factor. I'm not talking about the internet, but just as a computer alone, what we make today would spoil. Those things were ridiculous. When we started Apple, we thought, oh, what are people going to do in their homes with computers? And we figured, oh, they'll do, well, maybe word processing, a $2,000 typewriter. Maybe they'll do storing their recipes for the kitchen, a $2,000 recipe file. And maybe they'll do checkbook balancing and reconciling. And I guess that gets done a little bit now with Quicken. But pretty much our idea is if that had been what computers did, it would have gone nowhere. But the rest of the world could write programs and think up ideas and develop music cards and turn it into music. And eventually we got disks. The spreadsheet program was the first killer app. It changed the world. A spreadsheet. A guy, in those days, if you were a manager in a business and you wanted some forms to make your decisions on, you'd send in a report, a form to the computer department. They would run it, and based on all their numbers of information, sales and inventory, they'd send you a report, and you'd say, that's not right, I want it done this way, and you'd get it back, and it took days to get a report. Now you could sit down, type the numbers into your own little computer, income and expenses, January, February, March, all the way to December. Make a change in January and instantly see what the results would be. You could forecast your business. Small businessmen walked into computer stores, bought this thing. Our sales shot up 10 times. We were a big, successful company going public, you know, like Facebook, Google, all those things. That was when we really, really made it. Yeah. It was based on a killer app. One important application said a computer alone is not the solution. A computer plus a program that does a job you need, that is what people really want to buy.
Is there something out there right now that you think of as the next killer app? Is there a Steve Wozniak out there that we need to know about?
Well, there always are, but you never spot them in advance. You could never know. One of the things is I like to tell people, especially young entrepreneurs, is when you go through a business school and you learn all the procedures and maybe you write a form and raise some money for an idea you have that's good, and then we'll hire some engineers. Maybe they're in India. We don't care. We'll find them. No. Always try to have engineers involved in your startup, because engineers have gone through, but not just engineers that are academic, ones that have actually built things on their own, can turn an idea into a real demonstration, a real working model. Get to find those kind of guys and include them, because they'll think of things you never thought of as a business major, say. So always try to have both elements are important, and marketing is very important too. But what does marketing mean? Understanding the market out there, the people that are going to buy it. I say, that's not good. That's just average and normal, and everyone talks that way. You need somebody who is the market, who wants the product for themselves, overseeing all of its features. Just like Steve Jobs, every little nitpicking thing about the iPhone, when he came back to Apple, he could execute. All the little details have to be just right. Elon Musk, the Tesla automobile being designed, who would ever design a big car that was electric for his own family, his own needs, where he lived in California, determined the first supercharger stations. The Apple II was just for the machine I wanted. I developed Breakout for Atari. Now I could write it as a program.
I actually love what you're talking about, which is developing it for yourself, which means you have both the expertise and the fun element. And that reminds me, this is the business card that you use, that you've given me.
I call it a name card, because I don't think of myself as a businessman as much as a person.
A name card. That's very true. Tell us about this.
This is generation 3 of my metal business cards, but after 9/11, I like to play with systems, you know, just kind of push the limits up to the point of not really getting in jail. But so after 9/11, I'd go on airplanes, and they had these little plastic knives that wouldn't cut steak very well. And so I made these metal business cards, and I'd go on the airplanes, talk to the steward, is it okay if I, flight attendant, I'd say, okay if I cut my steak with my business card? They'd think I was some kind of nut with a paper card, and then I'd cut it with the metal business card. It cuts it so nice, it slices that steak so smoothly, and it worked. And then the stewardesses sometimes would come by and say, oh, a metal business card, but they never once said, hey, that's sort of a knife.
So I guess, talking about things that are pushing up to the edge, you've got to tell us the $2 bill story.
$2 bills, okay, yeah, sure. I like to do a lot of fun things. I like whatever you do in life, that's productivity and work, try to have elements of fun. Pranks are creativity, because you make them out of nothing. You make them out of ideas, It's just like come up with any idea and turn it into something real. But the $2 bill pads had a long history. I used to buy $2 bills and put them in serial number order and just have checkbooks of them and do unusual things. But now I found a printer in my hometown of Los Gatos, California. There's a printer. He makes pads for me, like pads of paper. And every sheet is 4 $2 bills. They're all perforated, so you just tear them off like green stamps. He gets the supplies from a higher quality printer. They meet the specs of the U.S. government. By law, that makes them legal tender. If they meet the specs of the U.S. government, they are legal tender by law. So I've been spending them for 20-some years. And I sell a sheet of 4 $2 bills everywhere I go. I sell sheets for $5. And, people, whoa. And I say, don't worry, they don't cost me $8. And that's true. And the Secret Service approved them 3 times. Secret Service is in charge of counterfeit money. 2 of the times the Secret Service actually saw the bills. And 1 time they read me my Miranda rights. This is true. And you know what? I was kind of pissed about that. So when they asked for ID, instead of giving them my driver's license, I gave them a fake ID I'd used for every airplane flight for 5 years. It said, it looked like Department of Defense, but to be safer, I changed it to Department of Defiance so I could say it was a joke card. And it was in a day when you couldn't get a printer on a personal computer that could print photo IDs, but I had a super expensive dye sublimation printer so I could print backstage passes and things. Other stories. So I had a card. I made this card for my ID, and it said, Laser Safety Officer, with an eye patch in the photo. And the Secret Service bought it.
I love the Department of Defiance, I've got to say.
I wish I had the $2 bills here to show off and sell.
On a serious note for our students of today, what advice would you have? Okay, I know you can't be serious.
Sure,
so give us advice. What would you mean?
I can be serious.
All right,
I'm very serious about this sort of thing. Yes, like you go to maybe academic subject, you study and study and study, and you know kind of what the answers is. Try to think beyond it. Is there something different? Matter of fact, go through a homework, solve a problem, write a program, and go back and think, is there something I could have done that's better than other people would come up with? Something very clever that can look at this from a different angle. And if you try it over and over and over, your mind starts coming up with a method to build in little tricks that shrink things, that make them smaller, simpler, more direct, faster, solve the problem. Don't worry about the cases that don't matter, but only the ones that do. And you can develop that, and that just turns into the greatest sorts of creativity and innovation. You'll be better than other people. Mm-hmm. You can be the best in the world. You try to think of, is there a way I could be the best in the world at this? The problem is, mostly your life is regulated in any kind of school, including university. Mm-hmm. You got a whole bunch of classes. And you might finish the homework in one, now I've just got to do the other, and I've got so much reading, and there's only a limited amount of time. They don't let you pursue your dreams. Let me tell you what happened. Your third year of college, you get to kind of go in the direction you want to. And I was at Berkeley, and I was only taking advanced courses, graduate courses in hardware and software design. And I made the dean's list, of course, and I loved it. But what I would do is buy the books as soon as I could in the bookstore. I loved being in college because even my first year of college, I could have a job on the side and forward a few manuals for classes I wasn't even taking and learn more and more about computers. So I bought the books for my classes, and then over the weekend, I would hardly sleep, and I'd go through every single chapter, answering every single question at the end of the chapter, and I'd be halfway through the book by the time class started on Monday. Why? Why would I do that? I just loved computers and technology. It had been my whole life. So I wasn't limited. The trouble is schools limit you a lot as to how far and how fast you could go. I could have gone that far in sixth grade in this computer stuff, actually, easily. But, the trouble is you have everything else you're expected to do in life. That's the problem with the education system, I guess.
Fair enough. We are trying here, too, to try to give more.
Yeah, but it's money. Yeah, one teacher, 30 kids. What do you do? I mean, one teacher, 500 kids. You can't manage. Everybody can't be treated individually like they have their own teacher. And not yet.
I do want to get back to this. The person who is the disruptor in an organization tries to challenge people and say, don't be content with the status quo. I've heard you talk about it as the chief disruption officer. For an organization.
A little bit mistaken there. Disruption tends to mean a company comes out with a different approach to doing something in life that disrupts a lot of other companies doing it the normal way. And they got their money machine, they crank the wheel and keep doing things the normal way, company culture, but they don't say we should shift because it's so different than what we do. Hmm. Even Hewlett-Packard had that problem when I worked there. Hmm. We had calculators that spoke a language that computer scientists knew called reverse Polish notation. The real reason it spoke that language is we couldn't afford the chips that would let you write arithmetic expressions, formulas, in normal human ways. So when Texas Instruments 3 years later, came out with a computer that did that, we laughed. It's a toy. That's the way kids are taught to do it in school. And I thought I was the brightest engineer of the batch. So I said, I will try our big formula, a big statistics formula. It takes forever to calculate, and you can hardly get it right on a Hewlett-Packard calculator. I will try it on this Texas Instruments toy. I'm looking at the equation and saying, okay, which part gets done first? And I'll have to put some parentheses in, and I'll back out my parentheses. And I realize no human being is going to remember 6 levels of parentheses. What level am I at? Work my way in and out of this equation. It is impossible. But I cleared my mind. I did the important step. Logic can overrule. This calculator from Texas Instruments has to be able to solve this big equation. They wouldn't put it out if it couldn't do it. What's the method? I cleared my head and I said, forget that I know things. Forget that I know how to use a Hewlett-Packard calculator and organize equations in my head. Just type it in from left to right. Every parenthesis on the equation card, I typed as fast as I could, risking I'd even get a digit wrong. And the first try on this Texas Instruments calculator, I got the right answer. And 5 other HP engineers around me couldn't believe it. I handed the calculator to each one of them and told them, type it in from left to right, everything you see, and not one of the 5 could do it. They just kept thinking, I have to use my skills to solve this. So when we come up with products that make life easier, and you don't have to do as much thinking, people often ignore it. And the company culture ignores it and says, no, 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 we've got something very sophisticated. And, and they miss a lot of the turns in life, yeah, that way. So that's when disruption occurs. My idea is, companies should have a chief disruption officer they should have a little department that operates very independently of the CEO. Very independently. Now, some companies, like United Airlines, have a disruption department that if there's a snowfall, they can react so quickly and don't need to rely on the hierarchy and the bureaucracy and the time it takes to make some quick decisions. But that's a short-term disruption. I'm talking about long-term disruption of your entire business. There should be a department that's always looking forward to how could life change with some other directions that products might take or that are being taken by other companies, and how can we best be prepared to counter it. Very important thing. Chief Disruption Officer is different than a Chief Innovation or Chief Innovation Officer. And also looking at ways that maybe a lot of brainstorming. What are things that the world could do a different way that might disrupt other businesses like our own?
I think that's a great point, to try to figure out how could we become obsolete, make ours, you know, that's the chief.
Yeah, be prepared and avoid it. I think in recent times, you know, Nokia or BlackBerry, you know, wound up, their business wasn't impacted by the iPhone at first. Then went years and years, you could see stable, a huge amount of business, but then all of a sudden, the trends come. It's like an exponential curve. You hit the knee of the curve and something happens. Nothing happens for a long time. And all of a sudden, it all happens. And you say, well, of course it was going to happen.
True. So talking about your formulas for making everything simple and better, I've heard you have a formula for happiness.
Sure. When I was about 20 years old.
Now, everybody pay attention, particular attention to this, whether you're an engineer or not. Yeah. The formula for happiness. All right.
High school, early college, and this is when I'm working on my own head. I'm going to come up with formulas for how I want to be in life and what's important and what maybe are religious values and that sort of thing. But I'm going through that, and I thought, if I was a really accomplished businessman running all these businesses and directing these and doing mergers and all that, would I be as happy as if I just smiled every day and felt the happiness and joy? Telling jokes, enjoying comedy. I said happiness is the important thing in life. Yes, business, doing business and being successful could be what makes you happy. I don't deny, you know, it's not, there's one type of person. But for me, I wanted to be, humor was going to be very important in my life. And the formula I came up with was H equals S minus F. Happiness equals smiles minus frowns. Okay, sounds too simple.
But it's true.
Okay, smiles, pursue, always build a lot of fun into what you do. Making jokes is a sense of creativity. You're trying to think of things that are different than what people think they're hearing. It's very similar to creativity in designing products or making great new music. Frowns, how do you minimize frowns? I said, don't worry about things so much. If something goes wrong, you just deal with it constructively and progressively. If your car gets scratched, you say cars get scratched, and you wind up not frowning as much as most people, and don't have to argue. You don't have to win an argument because you have logic. They have logic that's different. You're both good. So don't worry. Everybody can be good thinking differently. You just have to convince yourself that you're right in your own beliefs. And that it actually minimized a lot of frowns in my life. It's sort of like a don't care philosophy in some ways. The only thing that really gets me frowning these days is whenever I'm using technology and I do a right human thing and it doesn't work. You know, and then they sometimes tell me I'm the one who's dumb because I didn't know there was some tricky little thing that you couldn't see. Oh man, I get so mad at those people because they're people like me that designed the products.
That's true, very true. So,
but that was my first formula for happiness.
I love that. I love that formula for happiness. And there's a very quotable quote of yours. I haven't seen the movie yet because I wanted to meet you before I go see the new Steve Jobs movie. But you talk about a couple of things not being binary. Would you talk about that?
Sure. Do you want to hear my second formula for happiness?
Ooh, yes.
A later point in life, after Apple, after we'd had some success, and then I had a plane crash, and I took a year off to go back to Berkeley to earn my college degree. My name was very famous, so I used a fake name. My Berkeley diploma says Rocky Raccoon Clark. That's the name. And I put on some rock concerts, and Steve Jobs came to me at one point and said, you know, you're not a music producer, you're a computers, you should be doing computers. You know, and I felt, well, entertainment's a big part of life too, an important part. So I changed my formula to H equals F cubed. Happiness equals three Fs, food, fun, and friends. Food is the necessities of life. Everything you have to be happy and have clothing to be happy. Fun is fun, and friends are people. When I was being inducted in my high school hall of fame, I gave that formula to the students, and they started laughing. I had to embarrassingly say, well, there might be a fourth F, like family. So.
All right.
And yours was?
Is there a third evolution of the formula, just so I make sure, for happiness?
No, okay. Actually, I'm very content with those two.
So I was going to ask you about, I've heard this quote many times in reviews and so on, about what you talked about, trade-offs in life. A couple of things not having to necessarily be binary.
Oh, sure. Well, for one thing, yeah. Well, that's because largely Steve Jobs was such an important person in the world. He really was the driving force for the technology we have today, although by accident. Because he was horribly couldn't execute, didn't understand computers, didn't know what it would take, didn't know what prices were, and failed at all the projects he ever tried to build till he returned to Apple. He really just had sort of a position getting his claim to fame from our Apple II computer selling so well and pleasing the world so well. But I thought about Steve Jobs a lot. He was, you'll see, if there's a new movie out, and he has one nasty part in it, you know, one of these Steve Jobs things where he refused to recognize a child that was obviously his. I mean, some of us knew all the people involved. But that's only one incident. There are about 100 incidences where he did things that no human you know could ever do. And is like he can be a great, important person, an idol to even me, but not necessarily the person you would call a friend or want your own kids to be like. And so in the movie, I say, well, I claim that we could have had all the great products we got from Apple, all the direction. We could have had even more and better. And if Steve had just been totally nice and wonderful to the world and giving and sharing, his legacy would be a lot better, a lot stronger. So you can be nice and gifted.
I love that you could be gifted and nice. We like to think of our Jayhawks that way, that we have people who are incredibly smart and incredibly nice.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm glad I married a Kansas girl.
I'm telling you.
People are normal. People are normal out here. I'm not.
We love it.
You're listening to Steve Wozniak, co-founder of Apple Computer, speaking with Neely Bendapudi, Dean of the KU School of Business. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Wozniak actually made two appearances at KU's Lead Center on November 20th, 2015. We've just heard the first. Later that same day, Wozniak gave a second talk, this time accompanied by his wife, Janet, who grew up in Kansas and attended Baker University and the University of Kansas.
And he really is like that. When I moved to California, I left my company car here in Kansas, and I figured I'll just buy one in California. But I had met him, and he loaned me a car and kind of insisted upon me driving it. And one day, Californians drive a little different than they do in Kansas. So one day, I kind of bumped into a car.
She totaled my Maserati.
Well,
just kidding. She dented my Prius.
So the first time I bumped into this car, I called him up and I was kind of crying because I was like, I wrecked your car. And he said, are you okay? And I said, yeah. And he goes, I don't care about the car. And I was like, okay. And then 2 weeks later, two people kind of sideswiped me and my car was pretty dinged up then. And I called him again and I was crying again. And he said, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm okay. And he goes, you don't have to call me every time you wreck my car. And I was like, I had never had a wreck in my life. And in 2 weeks, I had two. And then just recently, about 8 weeks ago, I was in a really bad wreck where a girl ran a red light and totaled the Mercedes I was in. And I was getting hauled off in an ambulance with a neck brace in on and a bodyboard. And I was thinking, he's going to get on a plane in about an hour, and somebody's going to tell him, because the car is pretty identifiable, that I've been in a bad wreck, and they could see my car. It was totally totaled. So I thought, I've got to somehow get a message to him, you know, that I'm okay. So I thought, what am I going to do? So I told the ambulance guy, I go, you got to text my husband.
Technology.
So the ambulance guy's like, okay, what's your husband's name? And I said, Steve. And he goes, oh, you have a lot of Steves in here. And I had about 20 Steves. I go, Wozniak. And he goes, like the founder of Apple? And I go, yeah. He goes, I can't believe I'm texting Steve Wozniak. And so I said to him, yeah, you get to text him. And I go, I have to think of something a little clever to say to him. And I said, what's your favorite car? I think it's a Tesla. I sure hope so, because I just totaled your Mercedes. And he 20 seconds later, he called and he said, are you okay? You know, but he's just so nice. He really does You know, total the Mercedes doesn't care.
Yeah. So you got to give us version two.
Well, I cared a little bit that you were okay and that the girl that hit you was okay.
Yeah, we were both okay, so it doesn't matter.
Weird situation. You think a drunk ran a red light. This girl had broken up with her girlfriend at the high school, with his boyfriend at the high school, and she drove off in a hurry, and she was crying so much she didn't see the red light.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Janet, we've talked about how at KU, you've had professors that truly inspired you. Would you like to talk about? I know you've talked about two of them.
I'd love to. I'd talk about a couple. Well, I had already started, you know, working on my degrees, but I needed a job because I had just lost a job, a teaching job, and I had just been divorced, and it was kind of like at the bottom of my life. And I got an interview with Ron Ost here at KU, and I remember the interview. He probably doesn't even remember it. He's sitting right here in the front row. Do you remember the interview? Because he brought me in, he set me at a Apple II and said, okay, I'm going to leave you in here for about a half hour, do whatever you can do, and then I'll come back and check and see if you know what you're doing on the computer. And I was like, oh, good. So he left me alone for, I don't know if it was a half hour, 45 minutes, and I wrote a program that did some stuff, and he hired me. So it's kind of like, you know, everybody thinks somebody that looks successful from the outside, they've never had a difficult day in their life.
Right.
But everybody has difficult days. It's just what you choose to do with those difficult days. You know, when you find yourself in a hole, stop digging and, you know, just try to get out of the hole. And so the one thing about Dr. Ost is, you know, he hired me when basically I'd just been let go from a job and I had just lost my husband to a divorce. And, you know, those kind of things, they help you decide, you know, whether you're just going to lay around and think my life is ruined for the rest of life or I'm going to get up and fight. And I'm the type of person that, like, when I get a challenge, I will meet the challenge and I will meet it head on. I'll give you just one more example of that, and then I'll talk about the other professor. When I was about 5 years old, I was walking along the beach in California. My family was on a vacation. A wave came up, took me out to sea, and I almost drowned. And after that, my family became very interested in all of us taking swimming lessons. And from that day on, I took lots and lots of swimming lessons, and I eventually became a lifeguard and eventually became a water safety instructor who teaches lifeguards. So again, like, you know, I could have drowned, but you can also kind of almost overcompensate. But what's funny is to this day, we'll go on vacation and I'll go in a pool and I'll see some kid trying to learn how to swim and I have to go over and teach that kid how to swim on a vacation. That's just, you know, it also goes back to that, you know, wanting to teach somebody or seeing somebody that struggled with something you've struggled with and you want to help solve that problem in their life. So that's my story about Ron Ost. And Ron Ost, I mean, we've been good friends since the day he hired me. I've taken some of my most important advice from Ron Ost. Apple had offered me a job in California. I think it was on the third year I finally accepted it. The first year Apple offered me a job in California, I didn't even tell anybody because I didn't want to go to California. I was flying out there once a month to do work, and I always like to fly home because my family's here. And I think the second year, I probably told some of my friends, and by the third year, I told my parents, and I thought, well, this is going to be a safety net. They're going to say, don't go. And I remember my dad saying, go, who knows what might happen. Well, I mean, look at my life. I wouldn't have met this guy if I wouldn't have gone to California. You know, I took really good advice from really good people, you know, 15, 20 years later, still from my KU professor, and he was kind of the final straw that got me to take the job in California. And you never know, you know, when you're going down a road, you're going down a path, and you never know what one decision can kind of change your whole entire life for the better or for the worse. But it was, in my case, it was for the better. And the other professor I wanted to talk a little bit about was my favorite biology professor here, and that's Chip Taylor. And this sounds kind of crazy, but his office, his buildings are kind of over here on the West Campus. And he used to take us as, you know, grad students. I remember my first class with him. I took the class because I read the description and I loved it. I thought it looked like a really interesting class. And I walked into class the first day and they were all PhD students. And they said, are you new in the PhD program? I said, no, I'm a master's degree student. And they said, what are you doing in this class? This is the worst class. We've all been putting it off for 7 years. We have to take this class. You're taking this class as an elective? And I was like, yeah, it looked really interesting to me, so I thought I'd take it. Well, Chip Taylor taught me so much about learning, about science, about thinking. I remember one day we were over in the West Campus, and he set us all around his building and told us we had to sit out in the field in nature for an hour with a piece of paper and pencil. Today it would be a computer, but with a piece of paper and pencil. And we had to write down every single thought that came out of our mind without filtering it. So the human body will automatically filter stuff. You'll say, I'm not going to write that down. That's a dumb idea. And what his point was, write down every single idea, because then you can see what the best ideas are, what the worst ideas are, and you'll just brainstorm and you'll come up with things that you hadn't thought of. And, you know, after about an hour of writing down everything you saw or thought of in nature, you're starting to run out of things, but that's when you really probably come up with your greatest idea. And that's when you really think. And so that was a skill that I took a lot with me at Apple. One of the projects I worked on was in New York Public Schools. And I had worked on projects in Nebraska that were, you know, $2 million projects. Well, New York Schools is a $100 million project. And I remember on the five-hour flights back and forth between New York, I'd go out once a month for a week, and you had 5 hours on a flight to think about, you know, what's different in this New York Public Schools system than is different than, you know, South Junior High in Lawrence, Kansas, or different than, you know, any of the other hundreds of schools I had been in. So you think about that, and then you can come up with solutions that, you know, maybe you wouldn't have thought of if you just kind of free your mind to come up with ideas.
When Janet mentioned the ocean, I thought, well, you don't have oceans here in Kansas, but Janet and I play a lot of games, puzzle games, word games, mathematics games. It's in our background. It's in our own education. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. It's easy to do. When we go to a hotel room, we judge the quality of the room by the number on the door. Does it make an interesting pattern? Is it a prime number? That sort of thing. So we were playing a game once. We were playing a game where we were thinking up names of places, and it was my turn. I had to come up with a name of a place that started with F, and I'd used everyone I knew. So I said, Freeport. She says, Freeport where? Freeport, Kansas. She says, right. Well, we Googled it, and we found out it's the smallest incorporated city in America.
I said there wasn't a Freeport there. In Kansas. There's no oceans. We don't have any Freeports. He proved
it's
me
real.
Wrong.
We do, huh? Talking about, you're always looking at these logic and patterns. That's the answer from Janet as well. So, Waz, can you tell us what led to Apple One? I've got to ask you.
What led to Apple One was my entire desire in my life, thinking I could be more productive and get more things done than anyone else if I owned my own computer. I told my father in high school, we didn't have any computers around. Nobody ever heard of them. They were farther off than rocket science. I'm going to own my own computer someday. He said, it costs as much as a house. I said, I'll live in an apartment. So I, when I, and I watched, and I worked at a company, Hewlett Packard, and I was designing the hottest product of the time, and we shared a computer among 40 engineers. We would sign up for time slots and write programs. It was part of my job. And then when I created my own computer, because I finally saw the formula to doing it at a reasonable cost, a computer that could do useful things, not just be called a computer, but really do useful things. And I brought it in. I would run my own programs. Man, I was a star. Yeah, so Steve Jobs, after I developed this computer, I developed it not because I was an engineer and wanted a computer. That wasn't the only reason. I was driven and motivated by professors from Stanford and Berkeley meeting in a club we had called the Homebrew Computer Club that met at Stanford Linear Accelerator Center every 2 weeks. And they were talking about how once we had these computers, you could type messages into big computers and other people could read it. You could share things like nothing before. If all of a sudden your war march route changed, you could notify everybody, you know, where you had no way to do it by pencil and paper and picking up phones and trying to call everyone. Wow, that was exciting. And education. Somebody got up there, Jim Warren, a professor at Stanford, said, you know what, once we have these computers, a student will do the homework and be told right away if it's right or wrong, rather than waiting till the next day to find out. My example is if your dog poops on the floor, you don't whack it on the head the next day, right? Immediacy of reward and punishment is very important. And the latency there. So this professor said that now students, instead of using 10% of their brain neurons, we're going to use 100% and think totally differently. And I remember sitting in my chair, you know, young 20-year-old, being so scared, thinking, oh my God, these young kids are going to put me out of business in a few years. My brain isn't going to be worth anything. But all these great motivations, the social implications of how it was going to change life. A little geek who knew a computer like me was going to go into a huge corporation with a $1 million computer, and instead of using their computer, I was going to type the financial numbers into my own computer, use a little program written by a 9-year-old friend, and I would turn out all the strategies for the company, and I'd be more important than the CFO. Man, I wanted the little geek who knew computers to be important.
That's Steve Wozniak, his wife Janet, and Dean Neely Bendapudi of the KU School of Business. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.